The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thank you for listening.
Master Wu Men's Gateless Gate, Zha Zhou's Oak Tree, the main case. A student was asked, Master Zha Zhou, what is the meaning of the ancestors coming from the West? Zha Zhou said, the oak tree in the front garden. Wu Men's commentary. If you can firmly grasp the essence of Zha Zhou's answer, for you, there is no Shakyamuni in the past and no Maitreya in the future. The poem. Words do not convey actualities. Letters do not embody the spirit of the mind. The one who attaches to words is lost. The one who abides with letters will remain in delusion. This is one of Zha Zhou's very well-known koans. Of course, he didn't make it a koan. He was just responding to a question that came later. And although it doesn't really have anything to do with the koan, given the weather we're having, autumn, the magnificence of the trees, it's hard not to think about the trees. Years ago, we did a retreat at the temple on trees, and it ended up in the Prospect Park. But at the beginning, I asked people to share if they had a memory of a tree that was important in their lives. And it was interesting. Every single person spoke about a tree, at least one tree that had been really important to them for all kinds of reasons, and often with a lot of emotion. When I was in the fourth grade, maybe fifth grade, my class was on the way to school to lunch cafeteria, and my teacher asked me to hold the door open between the hallway so the kids, including me, could pass by. And as Cindy Phillips passed by, she kissed me on the cheek. That was another good day. But at that moment, I smelled a scent that I'd never smelled before. And it was gone. And I assumed it was maybe something you were wearing. We're in the fifth grade, you know, so weren't really wearing perfume. So that was that. Years went by. And one day, I was a teenager, I don't know, 16, 17, walking in the woods with a friend. And I picked up a sycamore leaf. And on the back, you know, when they're green, they're kind of furry. And I smelled it, and it was exactly that smell. I don't know. I still don't know. Joan Maloof said, to all humans who speak up to defend the living things that have no voice, imagine a world without trees. What does that feel like? Beyond our inability to even live in such a world, biologically, how would it feel? What would we have lost? Indeed. You know, as people in that retreat were talking about the trees, oftentimes it was a tree that they went to. Sometimes as a young person, when things were confusing or troubled or who knows what's going on at home, a little bit of chaos, they would go to this tree. I still find that strength, that kinship among these standing giants, these beings that have been around for millions of years. There's a theory that we actually co-evolved, the fact that we exhale carbon dioxide, they inhale and exhale oxygen, we have a, is that an accident? So, but as I said, that doesn't really have anything to do with koan. In fact, to really encounter Zhao Zhou's oak tree, we have to enjoy all of that for a moment and then let it go. All of our ideas. In Shantideva's chapter on wisdom, prajna, he said, the Buddha taught, at the very beginning of that chapter, he said, the Buddha taught all of the method practices explained within this text to help us to complete the training in wisdom, realizing emptiness. Therefore, those who wish to liberate themselves and others from suffering should strive to develop this wisdom. The two truths are explained as conventional truths and ultimate truths. Ultimate truth, emptiness, is a non-affirming negative phenomenon that cannot be realized directly by a mind that has dualistic appearance, for such minds are conventional and thus have mistaken awareness. And this is such an essential part of Buddhist teaching, the two truths. It really evolved later. The Buddha didn't really speak of it this way, but it really evolved later in Mahayana Buddhism. The paramitas that we've been studying, giving and patience and vigor and the precepts, meditation, as the teachings make clear, become fully liberated when they're endowed with prajna, wisdom. And they can be practiced, all of them, at any point along the way, which is good. To see into the non-duality, that all things have the same nature, that they abide peacefully within them, their own state, and therefore there is no inherent conflict, that they are originally complete, and know how to be with everything else. Conventional reality is the experience of things as they appear. What we see, what we hear, what we feel, what we taste. Shantideva said, ultimate truth is a non-affirming negative phenomenon. And so like in the Heart Sutra, Oblikiteshvara, so emptiness of the five conditions. No eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind, no realm of sight, no realm of consciousness. All of these negations and no affirmations. It is not this, but it is this. Right? We keep waiting for that. Okay, no, but give me a yes, right? Where do I turn to? What do I hold on to? If I let go of this, what can I have in exchange? Where can I stake myself? That is not given, because that would be another stake that would tether us. And so it is non-affirming. The affirmation comes through our experience that there is nothing to hold on to. As Zadarosh used to say, when you let go of everything, what remains? We might think, nothing. It's just a big, empty blah. But then he would say, in answer, everything remains. The world is now exactly the same, but in a sense, even more abundant, because there's nothing constricting, limiting, diminishing. Samsara is to live in the world where things appear as they do, and we take that as true and complete. That's the story. And we each have that story in our mind as we look out. The Buddha said to realize a peace in that way is, we will not find it. But nor will we find a peace in some experience or state that has no relation to the world. In other words, the idea that if I can go somewhere or do something and find peace that is now completely separate from the world, that too would not be liberating, because now what do I do? So non-affirming negative phenomenon that cannot be realized by a mind that has dualistic appearance. It's still bifurcates and segregates and distinguishes this from that, which we need to be able to do, but without imputing a sense of any kind of absolute. In the David Hinton's translation that he did of the Womankind, he translates the poem a little bit differently, which is not insignificant. His translation is, words can't say the life of things, nor talk render the loom of origins. Depend on words and you're lost. Refuse them and you live in delusion. Shibayama's translation is, the one who attaches to words is lost, the one who abides with letters will remain in ignorance. Two lines that are basically pointing to the same thing. But David's translation really shows a whole different aspect, which is seems important. So non-affirming means to allow things to be in their original state without manipulating, without trying to control, without trying to correct or improve. And that's what our Zazen practice is. And the tension is that if we do what we habitually try and do, which is correct, improve, manage, manipulate, and so on, then we're just doing the same old thing, and we're at war with ourselves and whatever arises. But too often, the only apparent alternative to that is to just become passive. But then things just continue on as they are. So that the tension, the necessary tension, is how to radically free ourselves, but without trying to control or manage. How to free ourselves without doing that vis-a-vis an idea of what that means, what it will be like, and therefore how we have to go about it. And so the Buddha said we will tend to swing and oscillate between too tight and too loose. Too tight and too loose. And that's not something that we're not going to resolve that by figuring it out. 50% of that, 50% of this. We have to experience it. We have to be able to recognize when it's too taut. And then what does it mean to release, to relax? And then we have to recognize when it's too loose. And then what does it mean to strengthen, to sharpen, to become more wakeful? What is the meaning of Buddha Dharma is coming from the West? So this is a phrase that, is asking what was the intention from the Buddha Dharma is coming from India to China. But it became a way of saying, of asking, what is the essence of Zen? What is the truth? What is the true Dharma? Xiaozhou says, the oak tree in the garden. And in the complete dialogue, which Wu Min did not include in the koan, he just has that verse, question and answer, which makes it very direct, very terse. But then the student goes on to say, please, Master, don't teach referring to objectivity. Don't point to something in the relative world to show me, to help me realize something in the ultimate realm. Because that which is in the relative world is subject to impermanence, and it's dukkha, and it's subject to all the things that I'm trying to free myself of. And Xiaozhou said, I don't teach you referring to an object in the world. And the student says, well then, what is the meaning of the ancestors coming from the West? Xiaozhou said, the oak tree in the garden. The original teacher of Myoshinji, a training monastery in Japan, commenting on this koan, one of the ways you can see which of these dialogues, these koans, really had weight is by how many teachers would comment on them in subsequent years. So this teacher said, the koan of the oak tree has the working of a bandit, shrewd, terrifying, robbing us of everything. And so that's why the teacher dharma training is sometimes referred to as a thief, stealing everything that we hold dear to us. And not only what we hold dear, but also what we so desperately want to relieve ourselves of, but struggle to do. And though there's, you know, that kind of way of speaking of, you know, thievery, stealing, you know, has its role, it's not quite like that. Because if the student is not willing or ready to let go, they won't. And so the teacher cannot take something from the student that the student is not ready or willing to let go of. And so if something happens, the teacher or a teaching sort of penetrates, pierces, dissolves, releases something that we have been strongly holding on to. We might think that the teaching made that happen. And certainly that was a part of it, but really it's that we were at that moment ripe, ready. Shanti Deva said, and so this teaching of the two truths, that if we just continue to live in our senses and perceiving things as we do, with our minds projecting and presuming and making assumptions and believing and attachments and so on, then everything just basically stays the same or kind of gets harder. But if we try and free ourselves, see, liberation is just freeing ourselves and sort of, abandon the relative world, the conventional, and just live in some absolute state, then we have no life. And we cannot live our vows because we cannot be in relationship with anyone. And so if we hold on too strongly to emptiness, then it becomes nihilistic. If we hold on too strongly to the conventional truth, and Buddhism teaches that it leads to a kind of eternalism, that we think that things are permanent, they last forever. And so Shanti Deva said, forms that we see directly are just mere appearances to the mind. They exist falsely because the way they appear does not correspond to the way they truly exist. Buddha taught the impermanence of things to lead people gradually to a realization of emptiness, the lack of inherent existence of things. And this is spoken of quite a bit, that the teachings are gradual. So it's said that originally, from the Mahayana perspective, said originally when the Buddha was enlightened, he basically taught the Avatamsaka Sutra, which if you've read it or even just picked it up, and you're imagining yourself as the first student of the Buddha, you know, what are you going to do with that? So it said that he taught that and people were completely clueless. And so he realized, okay, that's too much, too soon, too fast. And so he began with teaching the Four Noble Truths, right? And all of those subsequent teachings that he taught throughout his life. And then as the students matured and developed and were able to hear and understand and put into practice these more sort of deeper, more subtle teachings, those were offered. And in those gradual teachings, and in a way, in the Zen tradition, it's all presented at once, but it's still gradual because we will only hear what we can, given where we are at the moment. We can only put into practice what we're able to put into practice at the moment. You know, when each of us received beginning instruction, you know, a legitimate question is, what did each of us actually hear? And what were we able, like what sense of that did we make? And then what were we able to what extent were we able to bring that into actual practice when we began sitting? And the basic answer for most of us is enough. We're able to hear enough, and we're able to apply enough to begin practicing. And then as time goes on, we begin to discover more and more of what we actually was conveyed in certain ways, but we might not have heard or were not able to put into practice. So there's still a kind of gradual development. To encourage people, right, to come to realization and not be afraid. So Mahayana teachings said that, you know, when we encounter the teachings, that it would not be inappropriate to be afraid, right? Because of what's at stake. what's being actually said, what's being presented. And so it said that when people first heard the Heart Sutra, they had heart attacks, right? And if, you know, if we think about what the teachings are, what practice is, you know, just sitting in Zazen and experiencing something very difficult, it might be physical pain, it might be a pain in your heart, it might be a difficult emotion, and that the practice is to not shut it down, not turn away, not do any of the things that we've done before, that we might have done before, but actually to sit in the presence of that without loving and going further. Don't love it, don't hate it. Don't just grit your teeth and bear, you know, gut your way through it. But actually, quite the contrary, become expansive, trusting, soften your heart. That's kind of radical, right? Don't see a lot of that going around. And not just to do that once, but to do it again and again and again. To experience something painful that comes from somewhere else. Somebody's mean-spiritedness, somebody's selfishness, injustice. And to be able to hear the teaching that my suffering that I am experiencing in that moment as a result of something that has happened belongs to me. That can sound a lot like blaming. That can be very difficult to hear, you know, and actually hear as it is intended to be heard. We can hear it and shift it into the way that, into what we think it's saying, which is, wait a minute, this happened to me. Why am I the responsible for my own suffering? And so, gradual. And so the questioner asked Shantideva, so then is it incorrect to say that things exist even conventionally, since all things are empty? And of course, here the danger is, and this is why Shantideva is bringing it up in the question that he himself is presenting. He's asking for anyone who might think this, is so that we don't fall into a sense of nihilism, right? Which can very easily lead to a sense of meaninglessness and purposelessness. And this is not an abstraction. This happens not infrequently. That as a student is training and encountering the teachings and really taking them in and studying them, and they're really starting to reflect on, well, wait a minute. If nothing has any inherent existence, then what's the point? As though inherent existence gives us a point. As though if we were each permanent and we would live forever, our lives would instantly become meaningful. But that's very often. Well, I don't know how many people think that but don't say it. So, but there are those who will ask, and it's a valid question. It's a valid sort of conclusion, valid in the sense of it's not uncommon. It's been happening since the time of the Buddha. Not because that's what the teachings say, but that's what we hear. Because we are in a dualistic framework in our mind. I exist means I have meaning. I don't exist means my life is pointless. It's either or. So the question is then, is it incorrect to say that things exist even conventionally? And Shantideva says, no, there is no fault here. Because things exist by conventional, valid cognizers. And this is just a term. A valid cognition is to have an ordinary awareness, cognition of something that is actually accurate. There may still be delusion, but it's accurate. So an invalid cognition would be seeing a mirage on the road and thinking that it's a pond. Or seeing a rope coiled in the corner of a shed and thinking it's a snake. We're seeing something, but it's not a valid perception. So things do exist as conventionally as we experience them through a valid cognition. These are the things that we experience every day that are actually based in reality. And that's why it's important that everything that we experience, given the fundamentally mystic nature of the path, which is that it's not, it can't be realized through ordinary perception, through thoughts, through ideas. It's not a problem that we can, through a linear path, resolve, and so on. That's why we sit. That's why we have to let go of that important but limited aspect of our mind. And then what we experience at every point along the way, you know, in terms of what Buddhism says, is that what we experience has to match what we actually experience in conventional reality. So if we experience something that seems to say that what we experience, what we perceive in ordinary reality is wrong, then either Buddhism is wrong, or we're not quite seeing it clearly yet. So that they have to align, which is a good thing, right? Because if we want to be working to free ourselves so we can live a life that is more free, we're talking about the life we're living, not some other one. Somebody asked Master Linji, what is the meaning of the ancestors coming from the West? And Linji said, if there is any meaning at all, you will not be able to save yourself. But then Shimayama says, well, then is there no meaning? And he says, alas, here you have missed it altogether as well. If you say there is no meaning in the ancestors coming from the West, then you have lost sight of the truth. So Shanti Deva says, from the point of view of worldly people, seeing things is seeing reality. That's all there is to it. It's an objective experience. But worldly people aren't then actually seeing reality, because the real nature of things is their fundamental emptiness, their lack of any intrinsic own being. And so then what are we seeing with our eyes and our ears? What are we thinking? That's what we're examining closely on the cushion. Something arises. There's a moment of cognition, valid cognition, seeing this sensation, this emotion, this thought, this memory. And then the mind proliferates. Kleshas arise, emotional response. We react. We deny, we grasp, we blame, we shut down, we self-criticize. That's what we see. That's the veil that is thrown over the object that has its own complete, true being. So Zhaozhou said, it's an oak tree in the garden. So when a photographer looks at an oak tree, or a botanist, or a poet, or an artist, or a carpenter ant, or a squirrel, they're going to see a different thing. They're not all going to see the same thing. Shanti Deva said, provided all the necessary conditions are assembled, even an illusion will come into being. Why? Simply by virtue of the longer duration should living beings be any... Why, simply by virtue of their longer duration, should living beings be any more true? So the necessary conditions under which we see things as in an illusory way, we're not really seeing it as it is, why should we see ourselves any differently, or each other? And so in this way, to let go of every idea about anything that we are examining through our unconditioned eye is the pathway to compassion, because we are seeing it as it is, not as we want it to be, not as it should be, not as it could be. I really like the training, but it would be so much better if. Session's not bad, but it's like meeting it in a deep respect. It's like all of those stories of the Buddha and the Buddha's disciples meeting Mara. Mara didn't arise as like, I hate you, get out of my way, you're making my life miserable. No, that never arises. It's just, I know you. Oh. It's like allowing something to have its own completeness, its own dignity. And in order for that to happen, something has to drop away. Thus, the teacher's comment about being terrifying. At another time, a student asked Master Zhaozhou, does the oak tree have Buddha nature or not? Zhaozhou said, yes, it does. And the student says, well, when does the oak tree attain Buddhahood? And Zhaozhou said, wait until the great universe collapses, and then you'll see. The student says, when does the great universe collapse? And Zhaozhou said, wait until the oak tree attains Buddhahood. Happens in the same moment. Collapsing, complete relinquishment, one undivided activity is a collapsing of every structure, everything that we build up. You know, just notice when something happens and there's reaction, a defensive reaction, there's a building up. It's like literally like building up a fortress to defend, to be prepared, to defend, to attack, but the energy is actually rising. And so to collapse means relinquish. David Hinton said, if you can face that place where Zhaozhou's answer emerged and see through to kindred intimacy, whole, cut clean through to the intimate essence of everything, then you're free of teachers. There is no Shakyamuni Buddha. There is no Maitreya Buddha. They cannot be found. Even the oak tree can't be seen. Why is realizing the emptiness of self and others liberating? Why? Shanti Deva said, if painful feelings are truly existence, then they could never change. You could do whatever you wanted, and they would not change because they would have their own intrinsic existence. They just are. Always have been, always will be. He said, and if pleasant feelings are truly existence, then why do delicious tastes not bring joy to one who is grieving? It's a simple question. If delicious food was inherently delicious, it would taste exactly the same to everybody, right? Everybody would love every dish equally, right? A cook's dream. But it ain't so. And when we're upset, when we're angry, when we're grieving, when we're depressed, it's not delicious. You know, this practice is based in evidence. Faith is essential and runs all the way through. But it is faith in order, like the gradual teaching, it is faith in order to bring us to the seat, to our mind, to ourself, to examine, to stay when we would not, to return when we have left, come back again, so that we can give evidence of what is true. Which means both the evidence of what happens when I cling, when I project, when I proliferate my mind, when I do not take responsibility, We are not just, you know, to study the way is to study the self. That's the whole deal. So to study our delusion as it's manifesting is really important. To watch what happens when I hold on, when I turn away, when it's too tight, when it's too loose, when I judge, when I indulge. Watch, because I will gain, there will be evidence that is affirming the teachings, what the Buddha taught. But now we're seeing it. It's not what the Buddha taught, it's what I know to be true, it's what you know to be true. And that's extremely important to help us to loosen our grip. Invoke the earth protecting divine beings. Express deep reverence for all guardians of the earth, human, beyond human, sentient and insentient. May we be inspired by their myriad virtues as we dedicate offerings to beings everywhere. We pray for their protection and for the fruition of their beneficial actions. Walt Whitman said that the earth does not complain, does not argue. It just continually arises in response to its conditions. When we make the conditions of the earth difficult, the earth doesn't argue. A great storm, an earthquake, a great fire is not the earth retaliating. The earth is not angry. It is just responding. It's continually maintaining itself, in a sense, self-organizing as conditions change. And so Walt Whitman says we should study the example of the earth. And when we see the conditions being made for anything or anyone that are not conducive to life, to liberation, to all that is good, that's the evidence. We're seeing the evidence. We don't need another study. So I loved what Hojin Sensei said last night about, am I dependable? Right? Can I depend upon my goodness? Can you depend upon your goodness? I hope the answer is yes. And can I depend upon my goodness? Yes. And be alert. It's not unconditional. Be alert. Lest I teeter and become undependable, right? But yes, may we be dependable with alertness.
Thanks so much for listening. For meditation supplies such as cushions, incense, liturgical instruments, Dharma books, and more, visit monasterystore.org. Support for your spiritual practice at home.